potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. For the Big Fat Christmas Show, I'm going to be talking about Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, Babylon, Living, Women Talking, and finally getting around to watching RRR. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the Banshees of Inisherin. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Kicking off the news segment with a reminder that we have a giveaway for the Halloween Ends Blu-ray. All you have to do is send an email to HalloweenEnds@FatGuysAtTheMovies.com. And if you can pitch a way to get Tom Atkins in a new series of Halloween movies, all the better. So HalloweenEnds@FatGuysAtTheMovies.com. We'll pick one of those out in the new year. Also, I have to give an apology to one of our listeners, Zeb, who had sent me a message via Facebook a couple weeks ago and was like, hey, what gives? Why haven't you talked about Kirstie Alley? And I felt bad because I didn't. And then I forgot about it last week, too. So I do want to give a shout out to Kirstie Alley, who, of course, best known for being the character on Cheers. And, of course, she did other movies throughout the 80s, but Cheers is really the one that she's most well known for. And then she did other series like Veronica's Closet, and she did Fat Actress, kind of lean into all of her body issues that she had. But I'll always remember her as the original Savik, the Lieutenant Savik in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So she's sort of part of the Star Trek family, and that's two major Star Trek performers who we lost this year, both Nichelle Nichols and Kirstie Alley. But moving on with the news, let's talk about the box office from last weekend. Avatar made $134 million for the weekend. And you think, oh, that's a great number. That's twice as much as the original movie made in its first week. And well, maybe a little bit less. But I think the first movie, the original Avatar, made like $77 million its opening weekend. So you think that's got to be good. Well, is it? I don't know. That's severely below expectations, which I was hearing things of $150, $175 million, even $200 million or more is what people were predicting. And it came in a lot lower. Now, there's a lot of things that could be happening here. People could be waiting to see it. It could be being impacted by the running time, which is over 3 hours. It could also just be that people are busy right now. I mean, it's Christmas, and that's why movies that release at Christmas follow a different trajectory than they do in the summer. Summer movies, you really get that front-loaded movie, and then they kind of peter off within a month. Whereas a movie that comes out of Christmas, it'll stick around for a lot more time simply because people are so busy during Christmas and the holidays that by the time they get to the new year, they get around to seeing it. But it's not all rosy for Avatar. It still has to make up a lot of ground. I mean, by now, it's pushing $200 million for its gross going into the weekend. And that's pretty good for the first week. But the thing is, it just needs to make so much money to break even. You know, we're in a sad state of affairs where you can make $200 million in your first week, and that may not be good enough. Or you can make $500 million in less than a week globally, and it may not be good enough. And that makes you sit there and stop and pause and say, you know, maybe we're spending too much money on these movies, as good as Avatar looks. The other thing is it's underperforming in China. I mean, it did $57 million over the weekend, which is great. But the Chinese numbers need to be a lot more robust for that. And that's partly because of ongoing COVID issues. But at least it's getting a release in China. That not having a release in China has softened the box office of quite a few movies on the international level. China's a huge market, and they're still dealing with COVID lockdowns and everything like that. Now, a lot of people have said, don't discount James Cameron. Look at what his movies do. Here's the thing. There's not much data on James Cameron's movies. He's released two other movies in the last 25 years. The movie-going of the American public is extremely different now than it was in the late 90s. So I don't think you can compare this exactly to Titanic, which I think opened with like $25 million in box office. And then Avatar was 13 years ago. And the way movie-going public was expecting to consume their movies is very different than it was 13 years ago. So the jury's still out on how big of a hit Avatar is. I mean, it's making money, but is it making enough money to make a profit? That's the big question. Another piece of news, James Gunn and Peter Safran have been put in charge of the DC movies the way Kevin Feige is at Marvel. And they're already starting to make some changes. They've said, okay, no more Henry Cavill. He's not going to be Superman anymore. And the reason for that is because they're recharging the Superman character. They're doing a younger version. And that makes sense, because if you want a 10-year arc over these stories, you don't want to have somebody in there in his or their 40s. Then there's questions about whether Gal Gadot's going to be recast. I mean, it's not been telegraphed yet what exactly is happening, because James Gunn has pushed back on some of the rumors that she's gone, but they're definitely not making Wonder Woman 3 that Patty Jenkins pitched. The big movies coming up in 2023 for the DC movies, you've got, of course, Aquaman at the end of the year. You got Shazam Fury of the Gods coming up. You got Blue Beetle, which I think exists kind of outside a lot of this. And you've got the Flash movie. And they just might reboot all of these. Just really let them run their course, but not expect to build a universe out of what's coming out in 2023. And you're not going to start really seeing the effects of the James Gunn and Peter Safran fingerprints on this stuff until well into 2024, if not later. But apparently there's rumors going around, and it's kind of been softly confirmed by Jason Momoa that James Gunn has asked him to do a Lobo movie. So they're maybe like taking him out. And that's one of the things I think is interesting, how Gunn's working with this. He apparently said to Jason Momoa, we're going to keep you in the universe. We're just going to put you in as Lobo, and then we're going to cast somebody else as Aquaman. And they also apparently did the same thing with Dwayne Johnson for Black Adam. They said, well, we'll still consider him. He's not going to be in the first part of this, but we'll consider him. Apparently James Gunn did a pinky promise to those conditions. So we'll see. There's a lot going to be happening in Warner Brothers, and we're going to be getting announcements going well into 2023. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's look at the trailer for the sequel, The Book Club, the next chapter, which is in theaters on Mother's Day weekend.
What? Oh my God. You're engaged?
When did this happen?
It was last night.
You know what that means?
Bachelorette.
The book says we can't reject our destiny. And I think we should all go to Italy.
Italy?
We might never have a chance to do something like this again.
Rome, Roma. I love this city.
I love anything that's falling apart more than I am.
You know, the first book club was fine. It wasn't my cup of tea because I'm not a 70-year-old woman, but it certainly seemed to work for that level. I mean, and if you recall, that one was a bunch of old women like Mary Steenburgen and Candace Bergen and Jane Fonda and Diane Keaton getting together and reading 50 Shades of Grey and then sort of rediscovering their sexuality. Well, now they travel to Italy and rediscover their sexuality. So, I mean, this is fine. This is sort of like a modern version of the Golden Girls giving a little bit of life to these elderly actresses, these women of a certain age, these actresses of a certain age. And I can respect that. I may not love the movie, but then again, I'm not the person they made it for. The next one I want to talk about is Oppenheimer, which is coming to theaters on July 21st.
We imagine a future, and our imaginings horrify us. They won't fear it until they understand it. And they won't understand it until they've used it.
This one. Look, Christopher Nolan does some things, but all of his stuff is so pretentious. It's getting overly pretentious now. The trailer's almost too much for me. It's so philosophical and contemplative, and you're just like, just make a movie. Are they weighing the gravity of everything that's happening with the atomic bomb? Every single step they know, with the guy, is the guy who's mopping the floor saying, gosh, this is going to change the world? I don't know. This looks like it's just their level of pretension is going through the roof with this one. And I'm not excited to see it. Oh, he recreated the bomb explosion with practical effects. Great. Everyone has radiation poisoning now. Thank you for your contribution to this movie. I don't know how they did it. But you know what? There's nothing wrong with digital effects as long as you don't rely on them for everything. So Oppenheimer, I'm coming cold on this one. We'll see if it's any good, but Nolan has not been pinging my bell lately, we'll say. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about women talking and about living.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas just like the...
Thank you.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. This is the last major movie review segment of the year. So we're going to be talking about some of the movies in limited release right now. And they'll be coming out in January into flyover country for everybody else out there in the real world. If you're in New York and LA, you're anointed and see these movies early. But let's start talking about women talking. In an isolated community, the women have been found drugged and sexually assaulted, and they must make a decision to fight against it or leave forever.
It is a part of our faith to forgive. We will be forced to leave the colonies if we do not forgive these men.
None of you will listen to reason.
We know that we've not imagined these attacks. We know that we are bruised and terrified.
Hope for the unknown is good. Just better than hatred of the familiar. And we cannot endure any more violence.
This is apparently based on a true story that happened in Bolivia, but they've made it an American story. It's based on a book that's a fictionalized version of the story that happened in Bolivia. And so it's sort of like this very restricted, ultra-conservative, it's almost, I don't know if they're Amish or Mennonite or something like that, but something where they're completely shut off from society. And the women don't even get a chance to read. They're not even taught to read. It's a very, very conservative, very, very simple community. And Sarah Polley directs this one. Now, I go back to watching her in movies like the remake of Dawn of the Dead or the movie, one of my favorite movies, of I think it was 2011, Splice. But she's since become a more artistic director. She does more significant pieces and such. But, I go back to watching her when she was younger in movies. Even I think she was in Baron Munchausen. The Adventures of Baron Munchausen was her first film. But Women Talking is, that's what it's about. It's about a bunch of women. And it's about the women get together in this community and they vote as a block on what to do, whether they're going to forgive the men for doing this, whether they're going to stay and fight and challenge them, or they're just going to leave. It's not just that these people were having bad behaviors. It was a system that they had set up. Well, what they would do is they would drug these women with a drug for animals because they have like horse tranquilizers or whatever. And they would drug the women and then they would have their way with them. And some of them resulted in pregnancies. And of course, there's the emotional distress. And it's an interesting look at the concept of sexual assault and how it works in a very closed community and how sort of the patriarchy in its simplest form, because, this is a society, it's a very closed, small, deeply religious, conservative society that the men are in charge. Like I said, the women aren't even allowed to learn to read. And that shows what the result of power is. And the fact that this isn't just made up, this is something that actually did happen in a community like this. Albeit in Bolivia instead of America, but it doesn't matter what borders you're in. If you're in this closed-knit community where you always have to follow what people say, it shows how people will take advantage of power. And when there is a group that is in charge, how that has an impact on the other groups that aren't. And it also shows how critical women are to a community like this. I mean, you think about it, it's kind of a joke, but if you grew up like I did in the 80s, where moms were starting to move and work out of the house because they had to. But you go back to like the 50s, women would traditionally stay at home and that would give them a lower station in life. But there's so much stuff that a woman does. There's so much stuff that a mother does. And they point out in this movie, the men can't really function without the women. And that's true. I know a lot of guys that honestly would fall apart without their wives. So I think this is an important movie to see, especially in sort of this post-Me Too generation. The big problem that I had with it is, and I don't blame Polly for doing this because she's following an existing story that was from a book, but by putting it in such a rigidly structured group, it makes it hard to relate it to everyday life. Because these women are trapped, not just by their physical location, but their station in that little society and the little power that they are given. And that gets in the way of making a greater impact. And there's one character in there that there's this girl who's trans. And I'm like, it's one thing to deal with that as an issue, but it just kind of complicates the story because you're like, well, now you've got this whole point, and it becomes confusing, and why is they sort of passively accepting her or not? It seems like it's trying to say everything at once, where it really needs to just drill down into a more heavy thing. But it's well done. It's a slow burn, but it's a well made heavy film about real world problems. Though at times it gets obstructed by the framework of its own setting to make a greater point that we can relate to in mainstream society. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Living. A stuffy London bureaucrat learns he only has 6 months to live and decides to make some changes in his outlook.
Mr. Williams, a little on the frosty side, perhaps.
Not too much fun in laughter. Rather like church.
What is it up? Small wonder I didn't notice what I was becoming.
Dad, you're right.
If only to be alive for one day. But I realize it. I don't know how.
This one stars Bill Nighy, who I absolutely adore Bill Nighy. I think he's great. And I love the fact that if you look at his filmography, he has these great British shows and great British productions that he's involved in. But then you look up farther in his filmography and he's in like the Underworld movies. I love the fact that he'll do both. He's sort of like Jeffrey Rush in that sense. And really, this is a movie that Bill Nighy's getting a lot of award buzz for. And you see this every year. There's always a movie like this that comes out every year that's this very British movie that seems somewhat niche. And it's really just focused on because of the performance of one actor. Like a couple years ago, we had that movie with Maggie Smith. What was it called? Something about the woman in the van where she lived by a van. And that really only got buzz because she was so good in it and the rest of the movie was fine, but it was her buzz. And that's really what this movie's about. It's about Bill Nighy's performance and the fact that he's very boring, inflexible bureaucrat in this London Public Works office. And he realizes he kind of wasted his life and he wants to live, but he has no idea how to do it. And then it's him kind of running across people that help him along. Like he just randomly runs into this guy at a restaurant or a bar. And the guy, instead of taking advantage of him, actually takes him out on the town and shows him a good time because Bill Nighy's paying for the drinks or whatever. And there's this girl who used to work with him in his office and he had given a recommendation to, who he runs into. And everyone, there's sort of like the buzz, like, oh, are they having an affair? When it's really not, he's like, I just want to get to know you. I'm going to be gone soon. And I thought we had a rapport. And it's sort of like that same gist of A Christmas Carol. Only he's not like bad the way Scrooge is. He's just stuffy and not very much into nonsense. And it kind of opens him up to say, it's okay to be a little bit silly and fun and have joy in the world. So it's a very sweet movie. And it's based on an Akira Kurosawa movie. That's, I believe, based on a Japanese novel. So, you know, it's gone through a couple iterations and facets to get to where it is. But it's very charming. It's a charming British movie with a charming British actor. It's a sweet story with a great performance by Bill Nighy. So I'm going to say Living rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, and Babylon. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the big animated film that's out this week. It actually opened on Wednesday, so you've had a little bit of a jump to see this movie. And that is Puss in Boots, or as Antonio Banderas says, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. The heroic cat burns through most of his 9 lives and seeks an artifact that will allow him to wish for a new set.
Well, I'm supposed to be a fearless hero.
What are we looking at?
Cats have 9 lives. Now I am on my last life.
Oh no!
Only shooting star!
Legend tells of a wishing star, of a single wish waiting to be granted. Kitties of Paws, I need your help.
Is the great Puss in Boots asking for help?
Well, you see, Kitty, please! That wish could get me my lives back.
This is a sequel to the original Puss in Boots, which was 2011. I didn't realize it was that long ago. It's been a while since they did a Puss in Boots movie. And it itself, the Puss in Boots movie, was a spinoff of the Shrek series. And I mean, I the Shrek series are good. There's some that are better than others. They kind of go up and down in my mind. I think they overstayed their welcome. They needed to only do two movies. But the Shrek movies are like higher in the public consciousness. But while this is it built from that original genesis, it's different than the Shrek movies. The Puss in Boots movies actually seem a little more grounded in the folklore of Puss in Boots. Now, I've not read much of Puss in Boots. I remember my father read me a couple stories when I was a kid, but I don't remember anything about them. But I'm familiar with the character, and it's not just a bunch of puns. And that's one of the things that I get irritated with the Shrek movies. And there was this whole Twisted Fairy Tale run that we had, where you had the Shrek movies and El Enchanted and Hoodwinked and the Gnomeo and Juliet, where it's all a bunch of medieval puns, and they just got so old and bad. And, you know, do something different and unique. And I thought the original Puss in Boots movie went somewhere that the Shrek movies hadn't gone, which I respected. I thought that was actually kind of cool. And they kind of do that with this movie too. And they bring together a good cast, because you've got Salma Hayek coming back as Kitty Softpaws. And I'd listened to a whole series of Antonio Banderas and Salma Hayek as bantering cats in a swashbuckling adventure. Now, their sidekick in this one is played by Harvey Gillum, who most people would recognize as Guillermo from What We Do in the Shadows. I love him in What We Do in the Shadows. He's fantastic in that, and he does a great character in this one. He plays a dog that's dressed as a cat. He's trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. Now, the bad guy in this is Jack Horner, you know, the guy who sticks his thumb in the pie. But he's grown up, and he's trying to get the artifact too, and he enlists the help from Goldilocks and the Three Bears to as the muscle to go after Puss in Boots. So there is that twisted fairy tale element to it, and a couple Shrek character cameos in there. But it's in its own story, and it's actually a really good story, and kind of this sweet story between the two cats and the dog that dresses like a cat. And you know what? It has all the elements to it that make an animated film work, where the characters are learning more about themselves, and they're growing not growing as people because they're animals, growing as cats. And I don't know, if you grow as a cat, does it make you just more cat-like? Because cats can be a-holes, you know. Anyways, it's a fun movie. It was one of those that I started watching, and I was like, well, this is just going to be a throwaway. There's always an animated movie that comes out right at Christmas, and some are better than others. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, you know, this is actually a really funny movie. This actually works. This lands. And I was stunned, because I was not expecting to like this movie as much as I did. And part of it is because Antonio Banderas really throws down for the role, but he doesn't take it 100% seriously. You know, he commits, but he's still sort of hamming it up a bit. And I think that that's when Antonio Banderas is at his best, is when he's playing a little bit with his comedic side. I mean, this is a clever and energetic animated film that is loaded with laughs and thoroughly enjoyable, if not tongue-in-cheek, performances. I'm going to say Puss in Boots: The Last Wish rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Babylon. Damien Chazelle directs this 3-hour glorification of Hollywood excess in its early years.
I think what we have here in Hollywood is high art. It's
party time!
If you could go anywhere in the whole world, where would you go?
I always want to be part of something bigger.
Yes!
Let's go! Something that lasts, that means something.
You know, when I first moved to LA, you know what signs on all the doors read? No actors or dogs allowed. I changed that.
First of all, Damien Chazelle, I'm not a huge fan. I saw Whiplash, and I thought Whiplash was good, but I didn't love it. And First Man, I thought, was a decent movie. And it had this needless controversy that I think was manufactured just to get talking points on the radio and cable news. But he also did La La Land, and I thought La La Land was so overrated. It's fine for what it is. But it was not best of the year. And thank God Moonlight won that Oscar, because it deserved it more than La La Land did. I don't care what Faye Dunaway had to say about it. Anyways, everything he does is a love letter to something. You know, La La Land was a love letter to Hollywood. First Man was a love letter to Neil Armstrong. I mean, just to tell a story. But here's the thing. I remember when I was watching a trailer for this. I don't know. It was around October. And I was seeing a horror movie. I don't know if it was Barbarian or something like that in the theater. And there was a trailer for Babylon. And I got to the end of the trailer and I'm like, I'm just exhausted watching that trailer. Not in a good way. Not like, you know, a movie can exhaust you and you feel like you've been through a fully emotional experience. Other times you can watch a trailer or a movie and you're exhausted just because you're like, oh my God, thank God that's over. It was just so much to deal with. First of all, there's some good things about it. One of the things I appreciated about this and about Pearl earlier this year, which is a very different movie, they both take place in the 1920s. But unlike Amsterdam, which takes place in the 40s, that has this muted look to it because it's got to look sepia-toned. The world was not sepia-toned in the past. It's just that's what happens to photographs that are old. The world was not black and white during the Civil War. Civil War was just as much color as the rest of the world does now. And one of the things they do with the cinematography in this is they make Hollywood of the 20s pop and sparkle. It looks great. I mean, the cinematography is amazing in this. And I appreciate that because too many times you get a movie that takes place 100 years ago and they're like, we want to make it look like an old photograph. It's like, why? That's not what it looked like. That's what it looks like to us now. And Hollywood itself was bigger than life. It was bigger than the pictures it made. Because you go back and look at these old movies from the silent era of Hollywood, and they look really kind of chintzy. Even the impressive ones look kind of chintzy. So I appreciated the look of the film, although it's very clear that they spent so much time working on these trick shots. And like, there's this one scene in the beginning that has one of those tracking shots that goes on for 10 minutes. And it looks impressive, but not at the expense of a story and not at the expense of decent character development. And that's the problem with this movie, as good looking as it is. And it has some great actors in it. I mean, Margot Robbie's great in it. And Brad Pitt's kind of fun in it. The main character, I don't even remember. He's sort of like a young Javier Bardem. He's boring. I can't even remember what happens with his character. But the biggest problem with this movie, it is 3 hours and 9 minutes long. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? There's no reason for this movie to be 3 hours and 9 minutes long. There's no reason for this movie to be 2 hours and 9 minutes long. I'm halfway through the movie and I'm like, I got a whole nother movie to watch. There's an opening sequence. It takes a half hour to get the title of the movie on the screen. It's excessive. And the other thing that's weird about it is it's strange that we have a movie called She Said that came out that's about chronic systemic sexual abuse in Hollywood. And at the same time, Harvey Weinstein is getting convicted of rape. And then we have a movie like Babylon come out and say, wasn't it great when everyone was hedonistic in the 20s? I mean, it seems to be like glorifying it. Not just saying, well, this is what happened. It's glorifying. And at the same time, it's supposed to, oh, we're all edgy. Like there's a, oh, we have a lesbian in here. Oh, great. Lesbian in Hollywood. I've not seen that before. I mean, sure, maybe that was scandalous in the 20s, but it doesn't land the same to today's audience. This is an exhausting, nihilistic, shallow, overlong, and conflicting non-story. But hey, the costumes are great. Babylon sucks.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking finally about RRR and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the Banshees of Inisherin. This previous and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and do a little bit of catch-up. This is a movie, it came out earlier this year, like in the summer, and that is RRR. Now, you may have heard about this. It's kind of flown under the radar for some people, but I mean, if you're at all involved in film, or if you're on film Twitter, which is just being friends with a bunch of film critics, then you've probably heard of it, because it caused a huge splash this summer. It's an Indian movie, and it embodies everything about the Indian movie industry in a very quality way, because some of the Indian stuff gets really cheesy, as American stuff does. I mean, it's just all budget and stuff. But especially if you go back to some of the stuff from the 70s and 80s, it can be pretty cheesy. But they have some pretty slick-looking stuff now. And it's here's another movie that's like 3 hours long, But I'm okay with this one being 3 hours long, partly because Indian movies tend to be long. Because they have, like, songs and dance numbers and stuff like that. And they really do. So, finally, I'm getting around to watching RRR, because I needed to see it, and I knew it was going to be getting best of lists and everything, so I just had a chance to watch it. And it's on Netflix. And you can get, and I know this is heresy, but you can get the dubbed version or the subtitled version. I also could not find a English dubbed trailer for it, and I don't like to play foreign language trailers, because when this goes out on the radio, I get dozens of program directors going, what is somebody saying? Are they swearing? I don't know. It's in Hindi, so I don't know. So the closest thing I could find was the Honest trailer from Screen Junkies. And so I decided to cut a trailer from that. So here we go. In RRR, this epic Indian adventure sees two folk heroes become friends and then find themselves on either side of the British occupation.
Follow the story of two real historical figures. Raju is a Delhi police officer who's always hot. Bean is a jungle warrior who's always wet. When fate makes them all hot and wet together, their bond grows so powerful as these two brothers in arms speak the universal language of beatdowns, dance battles, and casual horse versus motorcycle beach racing. That's just something they do in an Now We're Friends montage. It's not even part of the plot.
Like I said, it's indicative of an Indian movie. It's 3 hours long and it has multiple parts to it. Not that they're broken up, but there's sort of like different waves in this movie. Like there's a whole section in there, and they mention this in the Honest trailer, where these two people just become friends. And it's sort of like this 45-minute story of their friendship that goes on outside of the actual overarching story. But it is about these two real folk heroes in India, and it's all put against the backdrop of the British occupation, which if you've done any sort of study about this, or if you just watch some cinema, because now with more Indians in America and more Indians paying attention to our movies, you're getting a lot more Indian stories about this, and you're seeing stuff about the partition, and you're seeing stuff about the colonialism and the damage that colonialism of the British did to India as a country, because it was that sort of manifest destiny. We can come in and just rape and pillage your resources. So the British are the bad guys in this one. And like they're the bad guys by a mile. So the movie's fun. I mean, it's an exciting movie. It is long, but it never gets boring. And that's, you know, compared that to like Babylon, which I was talking about in the last segment, that is just exhausting. And this one feels exhausting, but you're like, you feel exhilarated after seeing it. The song and dance numbers are great. I mean, they're absurd, but that's how these Indian movies work. But they're so fun to watch. One of the things that is a little bit disingenuous that I've been hearing people talk about is there's, oh, look at how great the special effects are. They don't just use CGI because it's easier. They make everyone look awesome. And I'm like, yeah, the special effects are okay. They're not great. They look great for a movie that you would expect to not look good. But that's just kind of how Americans look at Indian cinema. But if you had the level of special effects in this movie and you put him in a Marvel movie, people would make fun of it. I mean, they got like, there's like a scene where he uses all these animals. One of the guys uses these animals to attack the British. I mean, like tigers and wolves and oxen and everything. And if this CGI was in an American movie, people would have made fun of it because it doesn't look great. It looks good, but it doesn't look at the level of, you know, Avatar is worlds beyond it. So, and heck, even Thor Love and Thunder's worlds beyond it. But it's an exhilarating, fun movie. If you want an introduction to Indian cinema, check this out. Not everything's going to be like it. This is sort of like the pinnacle of it. But, you know, even something, I've seen some of these movies, and like there was this movie called Robot. Oh, gosh, it must have been about 15 years ago. And that thing's just a bonkers, crazy sci-fi movie. Again, 3 hours long with big dance numbers in it. But yeah, this is a lot of fun. I totally see why people are exhilarated and love seeing RRR. So I'm going to have to say RRR. It's an adventure that sizzles with energy and fun and offering grand spectacle and drama. RRR totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on one of my favorite movies of the year, actually my favorite movie of the year, and that is The Banshees of Inisherin. Two friends in 1920s Ireland have a falling out with gruesome consequences.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me. I just don't like you no more.
You didn't like me yesterday.
Why does he not want to be friends with you no more? Why is he 12?
If you don't stop talking to me, and if you don't stop bothering me, I have a set of shears at home. And each time you bother me from this day on, I'll take those shears and I'll take one of my fingers off with them. And I'll give that finger to you until I have no fingers left.
This is directed by Martin McDonagh, who did In Bruges, and he also did Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And if you've seen In Bruges, and it's been a while, I haven't watched it, I got to go back and check that one out. That one had Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson in it. And they have a really good chemistry. It's a dry chemistry, but that's the way these movies are. And McDonagh's movies are very dry. And they're very funny, but they're an Irish sort of wit. And if you've seen British stuff, you understand the dryness, but Irish cinema tends to be even drier. I get into it at times, and I love this movie. It's just extremely funny. And because it's a very real, down-to-earth problem that people have and situations that people really have, because it's about these two guys who have been friends for decades. They've been mates for their whole life, and then they have a little bit of a row. And there's no reason for it. It's just that Colin wakes up one day and is like, Patrick, I don't like you anymore. You're boring, and I've got other things to do. I want to spend my life doing bigger and better things. And things just escalate to a violent degree. But there's still a love and respect there and an admiration. And the whole thing takes place. It's this tiny little island, and they call it the mainland, even though, I mean, it's really not the mainland because Ireland is an island in itself. But, you know, there's Ireland as the island, and there's a whole bunch of tiny little islands. And this is a tiny little island. It's a fictitious one, but it's beautiful. I mean, it's just gorgeous. But in the backdrop, they can see across the channel between their island and the mainland. You can see the Irish Civil War going on in the 1920s. And periodically they hear gunfire, they hear explosions, and they look over there and they make comments on it, but they're completely removed from it. And while they could have a connection to it, they really don't, because they live on an isolated island. So even though you got this great capacity of violence going on within earshot, it is out of their world. But at the same time, they've got this conflict interpersonally going on between these two characters. And I know it's not for everybody. And I mean, it's thick Irish. I mean, when you watch it, you're going to need the subtitles, because half the time you can't understand what they're saying, because they have very thick accents. And, you know, people like Colin Farrell, I remember when he came on the scene in the movies, he sounded fine. Cause I mean, he always has an Irish accent, but he had muted it a bit. Well, and then you'd hear him in interviews and blah, 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 you can't understand what he's saying. And the only thing that's harder to understand than an Irish accent is a Scottish accent. And the only thing harder to understand than a Scottish accent is a Welsh accent. But, you know, this one's at least Irish. So of the three, Ireland is the easiest to understand, but it's still, you got to pay attention. But it is a charming, sweet, lovable movie with some great performances. I mean, I fell in love with this. I mean, and it happens rarer and rarer, especially nowadays, because not all movies are going to the theaters or whatever. But every now and then I go to a screening and I sit down and I watch it and I just immediately fall in love with it. And that's the way it was. And, you know, it's available for home viewing on physical media. And there's not a ton of special features on it. They have like some deleted scenes, and they have a behind the scenes about, you know, making the movie and McDonagh and his relationship with the other actors that he's worked with before. But it's relatively minor in terms of bonus features. Really, the reason to get this movie is to watch the movie. It's charming and wonderful. Easily my favorite film of the year. So I'm going to have to say The Banshees of Inisherin totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this week. I'm going to need to go. We've got one more show in 2022, and that is next week when I'll be talking about the best and the worst of the year. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home, and Merry Christmas.